Improvisations to Go is about to commence. It can only commence at all thanks to the generosity of Aubrey's and their to-go service and the wonderful help from Dr. Craig and Debbie Jarvis. Thanks to them, now we shall commence. I love the way that Memphis, Tennessee smells. You can literally smell Memphis when you get off the train, the barbecue, the Mississippi River. It's all in the air. The humidity there has its own special fragrance. And for a second, I thought I could even smell the blues. But that was probably me. There's no shower on the train. I had booked an Airbnb that appeared to be walking distance from the train station. What's walking distance, you ask? Thanks for asking. For me, let's say less than 25 minutes. After that, I slowly devolve into self-pity. My Airbnb, according to an online resource that I won't name unless they sponsor this podcast, was about a 26-minute walk, so I took a cab. Hey, I had a sore stomach and a backpack full of very, very heavy jazz CDs. Speaking of stomachs, I can't stomach generic hotels. I will not pay $127 plus local taxes for a room where the artwork makes sense and the TV can outsmart me. The Airbnb was half that price, and it was in an architect's office right in the middle of downtown Memphis. And if you think staying in an office isn't appealing, note that I said architect's office. It was modern, cool looking, lots of light, full kitchen, well-designed, chock full of great photos, and a blender that worked really, really well. And the photos were photos the architect had taken of places that he had designed. Now, I will mention, he did come in and out like he owned the place. And that was the best part, because he brought his stories with him. Great stories. One about meeting LBJ twice. Another one about his girlfriend insisting he take her shopping in Dallas the day after the Kennedy assassination. Now, you might meet this architect, so I don't want to spoil the story, but let me just give you this much. You don't want to do something like that. Hey, fans of conspiracy theories, do you believe in secret societies? I don't, because my Mason friends told me things would be a lot safer for me if I didn't believe in them. But here's the closest thing I know of. The semi-secret society of jazz radio hosts everywhere. And you, yes you, can test out my theory that this is real. Here's how. Number one, become a deep, knowledgeable, and passionate fan of jazz music. This should take about a decade or so, depending on your schedule. Number two, become a jazz radio host. Number three, go to any city anywhere in the world that has a jazz radio station, say Philadelphia, Tokyo, Vilnius. Call them up and tell them you are a jazz radio host too, and you have just a couple of questions about the local jazz scene. Number four, get ready to be welcomed with arms open wide at Tanagra. Number five, forgive me for the obscure Star Trek reference. Unless, of course, you're a Star Trek fan, in which case you've already praised me as if I were
Kalis himself.
Number six, forgive the second Star Trek reference. At least I didn't speak Klingon. Oh no, now I've done three. So, to recap, if you follow those five easy steps and the one difficult one, you'll find a phone call to the local jazz radio station will immediately open up lots of wonderful doors. So for me, the first stop in Memphis, after I visited the Mississippi River, was Malvin Massey of WUMR.
Hi, I'm Malvin Massey, and I'm the general manager here at WUMR 92FM. And I've been doing this job now, actually general manager job for 10 years, but I've been part of the jazz station since 1992, 1988 actually.
Memphis has an amazing history of jazz music, including greats Mulgrew Miller, Phineas Newborn Jr., W.C. Handy, Donald Brown, Charles Lloyd. The list goes on and on. But when I tell people I'm going to Memphis, they always say, "Oh yeah, man, catch you some blues," or "You gotta go to Graceland." All great ideas. But nobody ever mentions jazz music. I asked Malvin, why did he think that was?
It's what the city promotes is blues, soul, and rock and roll. Yeah. But they've forgotten, or they totally ignore, the jazz legacy that we have here in Memphis. My dad was into jazz years ago, and he used to go down, there was clubs on Beale Street called the Hotel Men's Improvement Club. It was one of the main clubs. Count Basie played in there, Duke Ellington played in there, all the big names that came through, they played there. The people, of course, stayed in different people's homes because they couldn't stay in hotels and stuff at the time. But my dad was really into jazz, and he got me into it. He made us, we listened to it all the time at home. And when I got into junior high school, started playing saxophone because we were out at Corey Junior High School. Was just a brand new one when I started going there. And we were in the first band in there, and I started playing alto sax. Our band director was a trumpet player by the name of Herbert Thomas. And Mr. Thomas was a jazz trumpet player. He and Emerson Abel, who was the band director, Manassas, and well, all these cats. They had jazz bands around town. And at one time, back in the 60s and early 70s, Memphis was loaded down with jazz clubs. You know, it was a bunch of them. Johnny Curry's clubs, he had three clubs. There was the Living Room downtown, down on Hernando. There was the Music Box up on Bellevue. There was the Hawaiian Isle up on Bellevue. There was all clubs all over town, all of them were jazz clubs.
It's hard to believe there were that many jazz clubs in Memphis at that time, but there were, and Malvin Massey played in them. One of the guys he played with was a guy named Calvin Newborn. Donald Brown had told me about Calvin Newborn.
Calvin Newborn, before he passed, he used to be on Facebook bragging how great his brother was as a pianist. And then he'd always be on there bragging, talking about Elvis stole a lot of his moves. And people thought he would be, you know, just kind of delusional or something. But it's true, Elvis got a lot of his moving from Calvin Newborn. Calvin has a book out, I don't know if I have it here, but Elvis used to come down to Phineas' father's club, and they say he'd be the only white guy in there. And he really dug what they were doing. So Calvin's nickname was Flying Calvin, because he'd do these things. Have you seen some of the pictures of him running across and up in the air flying with the guitar? And then he used to do these pelvic moves kind of things that for black people it was okay, but when the white cat started doing it, he got, feedback on it. But yeah, Elvis used to come to that club, but I talked to a lot of people. Like a guy went to my church, he lived next door to Elvis, and Elvis then was really poor, and he talked about how a lot of the white kids would put down Elvis' family because they were so poor.
And a big, big part of Memphis music history is gospel music. In Donald Brown's own family, he had several gospel-playing musicians, top-notch. All throughout Memphis, lots of gospel players.
But you know, like I said, almost all the great players, to me, either played in church or they played in rock bands or both, or funk bands and so on. So even now, it's like, I don't know if you're familiar with Corey Henry, but, he grew up playing in church. And so, because it was that, it wasn't a big difference, as you know, between the gospel music and R&B at one time, especially when people like Ray Charles came along and you heard the church sound with his R&B stuff. And with Aretha, you heard the church sound with the R&B stuff. Otis Redding, you could tell he grew up singing in church. And so it's... my cousin William Bell, that's that sound.
I've got shoes, and you've got shoes. All of God's children, I got shoes.
That's a track called Walk All Over God's Heaven, courtesy of Don Bryant from You Make Me Feel. Now, this is a new record. He made it just a few months ago. He's 78 years old. He's a Memphis native. He's written for Ann Peebles. He's written a lot of hits. But like almost all soul singers and writers and jazz musicians and blues musicians from Memphis, he's deeply rooted in the church. That's where he got a lot of his music influence.
Yes. Well, from the beginning, now, my father was, he had a gospel group called the Four Stars of Harmony, and they were traveling around as I came up, you know, as a kid. They used to rehearse at the house and what have you, and, you know, the kids, seven boys and three girls, you know, we'd be sitting around listening. And I don't know, maybe that's what really came off into the music thing, watching them rehearse, listen to them rehearse and go over their tunes or whatever. That may have been, as far as I can see, what got me started.
One of the things I love about tracing through Memphis history is the interconnectedness of it all. Earlier, I was talking with Donald Brown, the great jazz musician and composer. Well, his roots in Memphis are very much R&B and soul. He had played with Al Green. He had played with Willie Mitchell, Ann Peebles. It turns out Don Bryant wrote for Ann Peebles. He wrote her biggest hit. And in fact, he's with Ann Peebles. But my favorite song he wrote about her regards her weight, and it's called 99 Pounds. That fabulous Memphis sound, like so many great records, came out of an independent recording studio, in this case, Electrophonic Recording in Memphis. But Memphis has always had a history of great recording studios. For example, Sun Records, where Elvis Presley got his start, Ardent Studios, which had great rock and roll records like ZZ Top, Big Star, The Replacements, and then, of course, Stax Volt, the home of Otis Redding and Booker T and the MGs. These little independent studios are just amazing places, and they employed a lot of musicians that might have been jazz musicians, but maybe there was a little more money or maybe even more interest in the soul music. I gotta wonder, when did all those jazz clubs that Malvin Massey mentioned go away?
It seems like to me that it was in the 80s, in the late 80s and the early 90s that the jazz clubs started going out. Slowly but surely going away, fading away. It had to do, I just really don't know what made it happen, except that it's so difficult to make a living as a musician here. And most of the musicians, you know, if you were a jazz musician in Memphis, you had another job, you know. Fat Sonny was a security guard at the Pennell Farm, and Bowlegs Miller was, what did he do? Everybody had another job. Everybody did something else. The real hardcore guys, they all went to New York or out on the West Coast. But that jazz legacy of Memphis is what we're trying to work on now with guys like Phineas Newborn. This new book that just came out from Jamil Nasser's son, who was a bass player. All these guys went to New York in the 50s, 55, 56, I think, and got out of the army and stuff. But they went up there playing with B.B. King. And they would open the show for B.B. playing jazz. And then B.B. would come out and do the blues show. George Coleman was a saxophone player at the time. He was playing alto sax at the time. But that legs those guys, along with all the others that came behind them, like James Williams and Mulgrew and Donald Brown, those guys, they all had to leave here to find a gig. And to do that for a living. And I think that had a lot to do with the decline of the clubs. And then hip hop came in, and as stuff started coming in, it was more about money than anything else. It just pushed jazz right up.
It's a fact of life. Things change. Memphis is a river in and of itself. Like the Mississippi, currents come and go, styles come and go, and economic factors definitely play a part. For a lot of the great jazz musicians like Harold Mayburn, Donald Brown, of course, Phineas Newborn, George Coleman, they all had to leave Memphis to make a living playing the music they loved. I talked with UT jazz graduate Hunter Deacon, who plays drums on a lot of the music you hear in this podcast, about this very thing.
Yeah, so I did not know initially that you could make a lot of money or that you could make a living playing music in Memphis, or what would just, you know, like I said, that's where I grew up. And there, I mean, there were places that did pay. There was a place, if anyone knows Memphis, there's a place called the Full Moon Club, which used to be above Zinni's East. And they let you bring your own door guy, so you could charge whatever you wanted, and as long as your friends would agree to pay, you could actually make a little bit of money there. Sometimes the High Tone would pay, sometimes the New Daisy would pay, but it was never very much. And then I moved here, and a few months after I moved in, played a jazz gig, and got a meal and $50 in my pocket. And walked away thinking, huh, so I can actually make money and get fed to play music? Wow, this is great. Yeah, it's hard to play regular gigs, and it's hard to make a living doing it. You've got to figure out other ways to make money and other ways to fill your time. So, yeah, if you really want to give it a go and make a living at it, you kind of need to go somewhere else.
Just about everybody I talked to agreed on this point. One thing where there was some serious disagreement was, what is the best barbecue in Memphis? And I asked just about everybody I talked to. Here was Hunter's answer on this very important question.
I have two favorite places, and I have two because there are two specific things that they do really well. Central Barbecue is where I go for barbecue nachos, and they also have dry rub barbecue hot wings, or just wings, that are outstanding. And then if I want a sandwich or ribs, I go to the barbecue shop or sides. And the funny thing about the sides at the barbecue shop is that one of your vegetables is barbecue spaghetti, which you gotta love that.
When I talked to Malvin Massey on the campus of the University of Memphis, which was festooned with a lot of football paraphernalia now that they're winning, I had a few extra moments and decided to go investigate their cafeteria. And let me give you this compact review. No barbecue anywhere. In the words of a fictional philosopher, that's all I'm going to say about that right now, and probably forever. After that bummer of a lunch, I needed something to cheer me up a little bit. So while I was on the campus of the University of Memphis, why not go see Jack Cooper? He produced a big band recording that is really one of my all-time favorite jazz recordings, where he interprets the music of classical composer Charles Ives.
I I'm Jack Cooper, and I am professor of jazz studies at the University of Memphis. And I've been here almost 22 years. I'd be coming on 22 years at the end of this year. I've seen a lot of things come and go while I've been here, and I also have been on WUMR on the radio station here since the fall of 2016. I'm also the staff arranger for the Berlin Jazz Orchestra, as I live both here in Memphis and in Germany. My past things that I've done, I was with the U.S. Army Jazz Knights and toured with them for 6 years back in the 1990s and was their staff arranger. And I've worked for Columbia Pictures Publishing and Warner Brothers and a lot of people, and as an instrumentalist, as a woodwind doubler, I've backed a long, long list of people. I don't even necessarily need to get into that, but that's kind of my background.
Including Glenn Campbell.
Including Glenn Campbell and Kenny Rogers.
If you have been searching for the Charles Ives, Kenny Rogers connection thread, congratulations, you just found it through Jack Cooper and his recording Mists, Charles Ives for Jazz Orchestra. You could even throw Leonard Bernstein into that thread because Jack Cooper studied with Manny Albom, who worked on West Side Story. I was very curious on how Jack Cooper got into Charles Ives to begin with.
My mom was playing Ives when I was a kid. She was a very good pianist and very good accompanist. And she and my godfather, he was a vocalist, a baritone vocalist with the William Hall Chorale in Los Angeles. And while I was in her womb, so to speak, she was rehearsing and recording an album with Bob Voris, my godfather, and they did four Ives selections. They did some Schubert, they did some Hugo Wolf, they did some other leader kinds of things, but they did four Ives things. So for about the next 10 years after that record, they were doing recitals all over Southern California, and of course all the other gigs that my mom would do and everything, but on the classical end. So my brother, who's just a year and a half younger than me, and I had to be babysat at recitals. So it was sit down and shut up and listen. And so I'm listening to Ives as a little kid, you know, and Hugo Wolf and all these different things. So I was very lucky, and my mom and dad were big jazz fans too, and that's where I got the jazz thing from, and I'd started on clarinet and so on.
Of that great award-winning poet, Robert Plant. Ooh, and it makes me wonder. It makes me wonder what would have happened had I grown up listening to Charles Ives instead of Otis Redding, Booker T and the MGs, the Beatles, Al Green, the Beach Boys. Would it have changed the way I play music? Absolutely, it has to. And if you grow up in Memphis, you pretty much can't help but pick up what's happening there. And what about the impact of history? One of the most tragic events in American history took place in Memphis, Tennessee. You cannot underestimate its impact. We'll examine that and much more in the final episode of Season 1 of Improvisations to Go next time. In the meantime, be careful, take care. We all have a lot of traveling left to do.
Improvisations to Go is a production of WUOT. This podcast was made possible by the generosity of Dr. Craig and Debbie Jarvis and their verified hunting poodle, Curly Sue. Also, thanks for the wonderful support of Aubrey's Restaurant. Like this podcast, you can get it to go.
Hey, this is Todd Steed. I wrote and produced this thing, but what really made the magic for me was the music that we featured, including music from Don Bryant, the Delvon Lamar Organ Trio, they'll be in a future episode, Joe Restivo, he'll be in a future episode, and Jack Cooper, he was in this episode. Thanks to those musicians, their music is available out there. A lot of the music on this podcast was created for this podcast. In this episode, you heard the great playing of Matt Richardson, Hunter Deacon, and John Harvey. Todd Steed played some perfunctory guitar parts, as usual. An update is in order. WUMR is no longer on the campus of the University of Memphis, and they're moving away from their jazz format. Malvin Massey is now retired. And here's an even fresher update. Due to the pandemic, WUMR is currently off the air. Things, in fact, do change. But sometimes, they change back. Also, an update is in order since I did a lot of these interviews. WUMR has moved off the campus of the University of Memphis, and they're moving away from jazz. Malvin Massey is now retired, and I wish him the best, and I dedicate this episode to him. Currently, WUMR is not on the air, so maybe they'll be back. Things do change, but sometimes, they change back.